The Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations present Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells.
Welcome to a special in honor of the 50th anniversary of the infamous Orson Welles Mercury Theater broadcast of the H.G. Wells science fiction classic, The War of the Worlds. During this hour, you will hear an edited version of that radio play, intermixed with the musical interpretation of the same story as created by producer Jeff Wayne, which is enjoying its 10th anniversary this year. But first, we're going to explore a bit of the history behind all of these creations. For some reason, this simple turn-of-the-century fantasy by a quiet British author has taken on a remarkable life of its own. Perhaps, if we consider it carefully, we will find that this story has never been more relevant than it is right now. Herbert George Wells wrote The War of the Worlds at the age of 32 in 1898, one of the last of a series of scientific romances he had begun with his first novel, The Time Machine, in 1895. He had managed to parlay a talent for techno-fantasy into a modest living, supporting himself and his wife and child in a small house in Woking, not far from London, England. The seeds of the story had been planted long before and had surfaced in various ways. During the writing of The Time Machine, when Wells projected his character 800,000 years into the future, he had him speculate on what humans might be like after such a vast period of time, imagining that they might have evolved into something inhuman, unsympathetic, and overwhelmingly powerful. Since he expanded somewhat on this theme for the later novel, we might therefore think of the Martians as remote descendants, come back in time to haunt us. He was also interested in the Martians in his role as a popularizer of science. In 1896, he wrote a speculative essay for the Saturday Review in which he contemplated what kind of intelligence might actually have evolved on Mars. But the most immediate inspiration for the book came from his own contemporary history, and H.G. Wells was an avid historian. He was repeatedly appalled at the way supposedly enlightened European nations marched in and annihilated native populations in small, undeveloped countries. He watched the Zulu nation decimated, saw Tasmania cleared of its peaceful natives by land-hungry settlers, watched the Belgians commit virtual genocide in the Congo. Little wonder that he felt inspired to pen a story about ruthless, unfeeling monsters with unbeatable machines that march unceremoniously in and proceed to slaughter the original tenants. When he began the actual writing of the novel, he decided to plant it right in his own backyard. He set it amongst actual landmarks of his home, with names like Mayberry Hill and Horsell Common that can still be found on surveys from that time, within a stone's throw where his house still stands, and in fact in plain view of the dining room table where he sat and wrote with pen and paper. It was a well-received effort, but perhaps paled for some beside his strong early novels like The Island of Dr. Moreau or The Invisible Man. He carried the alien theme through in his next book, First Men in the Moon, but interestingly now depicted the extraterrestrials as a race of small insect-like beings, not dissimilar to the occupants of modern UFOs, so often described by those who believe they have undergone alien abduction. In Wells's account, these beings are busy working away below the surface of the moon. They, too, are scrutinizing planet Earth. Orson Welles, no relation to Herbert George, was born in 1915, 17 years after the book was written. He read it as a boy, but when, in 1938, at the age of 23, he decided to call upon it as part of a series of dramatizations for his CBS radio show, he did not do so only because of its impact on his young imagination. He had grown up specializing in magic. His father, a globe-trotting theater aficionado living off a large inheritance, at one time actually hired Harry Houdini to teach his son some tricks. In many ways, Orson had always been more interested in fooling the public than in merely entertaining them. In theater, he had made his name by being blatantly outrageous, staging an all-black version of Hamlet in Harlem and a bare-stage, modern-dress, faintly fascist version of Julius Caesar on Broadway. But at the same time, he was primarily supporting himself doing freelance radio work, including a stint as The Shadow.
So you weren't expecting me.
When he began the Mercury Theater on the Air broadcasts, he was excited by radio's potential to suspend disbelief with just the sound of a convincing voice and the occasional effect or music. His company produced mostly well-known classics, such as Heart of Darkness, Jane Eyre, and Around the World in 80 Days, adapted for the 60-minute commercial radio format. But till then, he had never done anything on radio that was truly inspirational in its audacity, that had that Orson Welles magic. Clearly, he saw in War of the Worlds the potential to do just that. His partner and collaborator in Mercury Theater was the well-respected actor John Houseman, and together they hired young Howard Koch as a key writer at $75 a week. It was Koch who was assigned to work with the British thriller to update and Americanize it, presenting it as a series of real-time radio announcements. Koch, with a random pencil drop on the only state map he could get his hands on, chose Grover's Mill, New Jersey, as the site of the initial landing, coincidentally close to Princeton, where he placed the fictional professor played by Welles in the production. Koch hated the job at first. To make it work, he had to discard almost all of the novel. He actually begged Houseman to let him do something else, but was told that this project was Orson's favorite. In the end, he collaborated with Houseman on the long sections that were giving him trouble. As always, many last-minute changes took place before they went to air. These shows were conceived, written, and rehearsed in the space of 1 week, then performed on the Sunday night. Many on the show actually thought the script was silly, and at the last minute it was almost replaced with an adaptation of Lorna Doone. The censors asked for 27 minor script changes, mostly substituting fake names for real institutions or people. Welles missed many rehearsals due to other commitments, but his one key input was probably the one that made all the difference. Against the advice of everyone else in the company, he wanted the music bridges that separated announcements at the beginning to be lengthened so as to create the illusion of huge periods of time passing. With this simple ploy, he increased the credibility of the early section of the drama immeasurably.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News.
That this broadcast was intended to magically convince listeners that an actual invasion was underway was made very clear by his closing remarks.
This is Orson Welles, ladies and gentlemen, out of character to assure you that the War of the Worlds has no further significance than as the holiday offering it was intended to be. The Mercury Theater's own radio version of dressing up in a sheet and jumping out of a bush and saying boo. You will be relieved, I hope, to learn that we didn't mean it. So goodbye, everybody, and remember, please, for the next day or so, the terrible lesson you learned tonight. That was no Martian. It's Halloween.
But it is very obvious to a modern audience that an astute listener at the time would not have been so fooled. Not only was the play clearly introduced as a dramatization, but not very far into it, the amount of time distortion that is presented is quite unrealistic, and the last third discards outright any pretense of reality as it becomes a lengthy monologue by Welles' character,
Richard Pearson. I look down at my blackened hand, and I try to connect them with a professor who lives at Princeton and who, on the night of October 20th, glimpsed through his telescope an orange splash of light on a distant planet.
There are, in fact, many reasons why this single radio broadcast has become one of the most celebrated in history, why, despite the success of the original novel or the later film version or the album of the same name that you will hear tonight, The War of the Worlds is still inextricably linked in the minds of much of the public with Orson Welles and the panic he created with it. Even after a lengthy, stormy Hollywood career that included the creation of what is arguably one of the best films ever made, Citizen Kane, Orson Welles, near the end of his life, was still most often asked about the War of the Worlds. However much his genius may have been the spark that ignited this inferno, the fuel was very much present in the United States of 1938. First and foremost, this was only 1 year before the outbreak of World War II, and global tension was high. At the beginning, setting the scene for the play, Welles makes the following statement.
In the 39th year of the 20th century came the Great Disillusionment. Near the end of October, business was better. The war scare was over.
Which is reference to the Munich crisis of only months before. A listener, not hearing or misunderstanding early references to Martians, could easily have interpreted the chaotic military announcements that dominate the second quarter of the play as actual reports of an invasion by air and land with chemical weapons of a European enemy.
Citizens of the nation, I shall not try to conceal the gravity of the situation that confronts the country, nor the concern of your government in protecting the lives and property of its people.
People at this time were also extremely sensitive to disaster reports on the radio, having been universally horrified to hear the now famous live broadcast of reporter Herb Morrison as he witnessed the tragic burning of the Hindenburg Zeppelin at Lakehurst, New Jersey, on May 6th of the previous year.
The ship is riding majestically toward us like some great feather.
In fact, it is probably true that this single event was the most influential factor in the creation of the play. Koch admits to having drawn from it freely, and actor Frank Riddick modeled his performance of reporter Carl Phillips on that memorable broadcast. By this time, the general public had had the chance to see the newsreels that fused that horrible report with the graphic film footage that came out of that disaster, and so were no doubt well prepared to imagine further such carnage.
Get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast, and all the folks between them. This is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, four or 500 feet into the sky, and it's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now, and the frame is crashing to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. Oh, the humanity.
Another key factor was the state of the radio ratings of the time. The Mercury Theater of the Air, at 8 o'clock on a Sunday night, was directly pitted against the most popular radio program of the day, Edgar Bergen's Chastened Sanborn Hour on NBC, featuring Bergen's talking dummy, Charlie McCarthy.
The makers of Instant Chastened Sanborn Coffee present the Charlie McCarthy Show! Carpenter, ladies and gentlemen, greeting you from Hollywood, California. On behalf of Edgar Bergen, Charlie McCarthy, Mortimer Sterr, Don Ameche, and Marcia Hunt, and the Bickersons by Phil Rapp, Ray Nolbin's orchestra, and Pat Patrick as Ursel Twing.
As it stood on that night, Bergen could expect to have almost 35% of the listening public, while the Mercury Theater would have been lucky to get 4%. Wells would have been well aware that his only chance for that larger audience was when McCarthy introduced his first guest, which was usually a lesser-known entertainer, about 10 minutes after the hour. At this time, millions of radio dials would twist to see what was happening elsewhere. And when they got to CBS, they found themselves already well into the most plausible section of this credible-sounding emergency.
We take you now to Grover's Mill, New Jersey.
You can imagine the sudden thrill of horror that in fact gripped so many as they first suspected, then heard unfold before them a terrible invasion that would most certainly engulf them. Very large numbers of people were all feeling nothing but a welling panic and the primal need to do something to save themselves. There are thousands of stories on official record of the weird, wild, and undisciplined behavior that people exhibited, from which we can only extrapolate the hundreds of thousands that were never reported. Consider what the effect must have been like in concrete Washington, which coincidentally experienced a power blackout just as the most realistic section of the play was reaching its climax. Especially interesting are the reports of the traffic police, who would have been watching streams of automobiles, some of them families returning home from the weekend, many listening to the radio as they drove. Suddenly, these Sunday drivers became maniacs of the road, swerving abruptly into ditches and leaping screaming from their cars, or pulling a U-turn at speed and roaring off at breakneck acceleration. It has been often stated, and it is no exaggeration, that it's a miracle nobody died, and there were very few serious injuries. For Orson Welles, the immediate impact was considerable. During the program, the mayor called the station, demanding something be done. The governor put pressure on network head William Paley, who instructed studio police to hold the players in a kind of house arrest. While Welles and company sat in a back office, staffers seized all scripts and other elements related to the production. By the time they were released in the early morning, a crowd of reporters were waiting to beleaguer them with questions. By the time the day had fully dawned, there were almost $250,000 in personal lawsuits filed against the station and the show, such as the one by a lifelong stutterer, recently cured, who because of the show had relapsed and wanted compensation for $2,000 worth of therapy. Only a suspiciously brilliant bit of legal foresight many months earlier, when their lawyers had demanded a small clause in their contract relieving them of any responsibility for any consequences of their broadcasts, saved Welles and company from being financially wiped out. Also threatening to sue was H.G. Welles himself, who was very much alive. He hadn't heard the broadcast, but he had heard enough about it to consider it a gross misuse of his work by irresponsible sensation seekers. To the whole thing, Canadians responded with typical reserve. CFRB carried the Columbia program in Toronto, and the Globe and Mail offices recorded more than 400 phone calls between 8:20 and the end of the show at 9, but there were no reported cases of hysterical behavior. Ottawa remained virtually untouched. Of the 20 stations that could be regularly received in the region, only two carried Columbia programs, CKAC from Montreal and W3XAU, Philadelphia. At that time, Ottawa had only one radio station of its own, CBO. It is a fairly safe assumption that just about everybody listening to radio in the nation's capital that night were tuned into any one of the dozen Canadian and American stations carrying NBC programs and having a laugh with Charlie McCarthy. But a few Ottawa listeners must have been scanning the dial because a number of stories did surface, mostly worried families going to the neighbors to see if they had heard the news. The incident in the States was serious enough, however, to prompt the Ottawa Journal to run a small article on the following day's front page, quoting a local astronomer, that there truly was no life possible on the planet Mars. In general, the American press was scathing in its attack, and for a terrifying moment it looked possible that this incident would bring dreaded censorship upon the radio airwaves. But cooler heads prevailed, and when Dorothy Thompson's influential New York column appeared, declaring that Wells had done the nation a service by awakening them to their unpreparedness for a real invasion, the tide turned in his favor. The magician had struck, and the trick had worked, that's all. His official explanation was that he had updated the story because he feared that contemporary listeners would find the novel too old-fashioned and therefore boring. He said, quote, "We can only suppose that the special nature of radio, which is often heard in fragments or in parts disconnected from the whole, has led to this misunderstanding," unquote. The ratings on the Mercury Theater of the Air went through the roof, and a big new sponsor bought in for a long season. Orson had never been more in demand for radio work. But they never forgot. At one point, several years later, he was on the air reading a Walt Whitman poem during a patriotic Sunday program when a man rushed in and announced that the Japanese had just bombed Pearl Harbor. Nobody there in the studio, and probably remarkably few in the listening audience, felt this was any more than more tomfoolery on the part of Orson Welles. There were other hoaxes that imitated his masterpiece. In 1939, a Charleston, South Carolina station broadcast something called Palmetto Fantasy that did a similar treatment to a story about a secret military weapon that had fallen into the town's reservoir, and locally there was quite a panic. According to radio historian John Dunning, a South American station broadcast their own version of War of the Worlds and created such pandemonium that when it was learned that it was a hoax, the station was attacked, burned to the ground, and several announcers killed. It was not long after his notorious broadcast that Orson Welles made that magical step to the silver screen.
Girls, delightful in Cuba, stop. Could send you prose poems about scenery, but don't feel right spending your money. Stop. There is no war in Cuba. Signed, Wheeler. Any answer?
Yes, dear Wheeler, you provide the prose poems. I'll provide the war.
That's fine, Mr.
King. Yes, I rather like myself.
Took me 2 solid years in the best boys' school in the world to learn that trick. The fellow who taught it to me is now the president of Venezuela.
People will think
what I tell them to think.
Howard Koch went on to Hollywood as well, and next wrote a film called Casablanca.
Sing it, Sam.
Yes, boss.
It's December 1941 in Casablanca. What time is it in New York?
My watch stopped.
Huh, mine stopped, too.
So is mine.
Jeepers, mine ain't working. What is this?
Why, they've all stopped at the same time.
There's only one explanation for a thing like this.
It is therefore somehow appropriate that the War of the Worlds should next come to widespread public attention as a film. Paramount had owned the rights to the novel since 1927, but it wasn't until 1953 that they handed it over to that era's king of science fiction film, producer George Pal.
In the first
world war, and for the first time in the history of man, nations combined to fight against nations using the crude weapons of those days. The Second World War involved every continent on the globe, and men turned to science for new devices of warfare, which reached an unparalleled peak in their capacity for destruction. And now, fought with the terrible weapons of super science, menacing all mankind and every creature on Earth, comes the War of the Worlds.
In this interpretation of the story, the modernization and Americanization of the radio play is maintained, and the technology updated impressively. The alien machines now reminiscent of flying saucers, marching on force fields instead of tripods. One weapon used ineffectually against them is the atomic bomb. The original words of H.G. Wells survive in the narration by Sir Cedric Hardwick.
It was the beginning of the rout of civilization, of the massacre of humanity.
But in all other ways, the production was modernized, turned into a state-of-the-art special effects tour de force. Over 4,000 hand-painted frames were made up for scenes in which soldiers or equipment are annihilated by Martian heat rays, the sound of which was created with an electric guitar heard backwards. Originally, Powell wanted to do the film in 3D, and several effects were shot that way, but the studio vetoed the idea. The film was directed by special effects expert Byron Haskins, who went on to collaborate with Powell on several films, including Robinson Crusoe on Mars, which features the return of the same flying Martian craft. The most recent interpretation of The War of the Worlds is a musical whose storyline remains faithful to the original novel. It was created by a lesser-known British producer named Jeff Wayne, whose previous principal credit was producing David Essex, including this major hit single from 1974.
Hey, dear, rock and roll, rock on. And where do we go from here?
In 1975, Jeff started work on this album, collaborating with his father Jerry, a writer and theatrical producer who had the initial idea for the project. It was not completed until 1978. He called on a wide range of impressive talent, not least of which is the late Richard Burton in the role of the narrator.
No one would have believed in the last years of the 19th century that human affairs were being watched from the timeless worlds of space.
In interviews, Jeff Wayne remembered getting in touch with Richard Burton, never expecting to be able to afford the illustrious actor, only to find out that Burton would gladly work for scale because he liked the book.
Few men even consider the possibility of life on other planets. And yet, across the gulf of space, minds immeasurably superior to ours regarded this Earth with envious eyes. And slowly and surely, they drew their plans against us.
David Essex sings and performs the part of the artilleryman. The late Phil Lynott of Thin Lizzy is the preacher, and Justin Hayward of the Moody Blues sings a featured song. The part of Beth is sung by Julie Covington, best known for her work on the album Evita and its hit single Don't Cry For Me, Argentina. Chris Thompson of Manfred Mann's Earth Band is also a featured vocalist, and music on the album includes the efforts of such illustrious session men as bassist Herbie Flowers, percussionist Ray Cooper, and guitarists Joe Partridge and Chris Spedding. All the music was written and produced by Jeff Wayne, who also played most keyboards. All lyrics were written by Gary Osborne. The voices that are heard at the very end of the album belong to that of Jeff's father, Jerry.
Looking good. Going good.
You're going to hear an edit of this album now, intermixed with the 1938 Orson Welles broadcast. You'll be able to experience three things at once, really. You'll hear the original words of H.G. Wells from his novel, as read by Richard Burton. You'll hear the history-making radio play, edited and enhanced. And you'll hear the exciting musical inspiration it gave a modern rock musician. Here, then, is the War of the Worlds.
On this particular evening, October 30th, the Crosley Service estimated that 32 million people were listening in on radios. Yet across an immense ethereal gulf, minds that are to our minds as ours are to the beasts in the jungle, intellects vast, cool, and unsympathetic, regarded this Earth with envious eyes and slowly and surely drew their plans against us.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The spectroscope indicates the gas to be hydrogen and moving toward the Earth with enormous velocity.
At midnight on the 12th of August, a huge mass of luminous gas erupted from Mars and sped towards Earth. Across 200 million miles of void, invisibly hurtling towards us, came the first of the missiles that were to bring so much calamity to Earth. As I watched, there was another jet of gas. It was another missile, starting on its way.
We are ready now to take you to the Princeton Observatory at Princeton, where Carl Phillips, our commentator, will interview Professor Richard Pearson, famous astronomer. We take you now to Princeton, New Jersey.
Professor, you're quite convinced, as a scientist, that living intelligence as we know it does not exist on Mars?
Say the chances against it are 1,000 to 1.
And yet, how do you account for these gas eruptions occurring on the surface of the planet at regular intervals?
I cannot account for it.
And that's how it was for the next 10 nights. A flare spurting out from Mars, bright green, drawing a green mist behind it. A beautiful, but somehow disturbing sight. Ogilvy, the astronomer, assured me we were in no danger. He was convinced there could be no living thing on that remote, forbidding planet.
The chances of anything coming from Mars are 1,000,000 to 1, he said. The chances of anything coming from Mars are 1,000,000 to 1. But still, they come.
Came the night the first missile approached Earth. It was thought to be an ordinary falling star, but next day there was a huge crater in the middle of the common, and Ogilvy came to examine what lay there. A cylinder, 30 yards across, glowing hot, and with faint sounds of movement coming from within. Suddenly the top began moving, rotating, unscrewing, and Ogilvy feared there was a man inside trying to escape. He rushed to the cylinder, but the intense heat stopped him before he could burn himself on the metal.
The chances of anything coming from Mars are 1,000,000 to 1, he said. Chances of anything coming from Mars are 1,000,000 to 1, but still they count.
Ladies and gentlemen, here is the latest bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News, Toronto, Canada. Professor Morris of Macmillan University reports observing a total of 3 explosions on the planet Mars between the hours of 7:45 p.m. and 9:20 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. This confirms earlier reports received from American observatories. Now, nearer home, comes a special bulletin from Trenton, New Jersey. It is reported that at 8:50 p.m., a huge flaming object, believed to be a meteorite, fell on a farm in the neighborhood of Grover's Mill, New Jersey, 22 miles from Trenton. The flash in the sky was visible within a radius of several hundred miles, and the noise of the impact was heard as far north as Elizabeth. We have dispatched a special mobile unit to the scene.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Carl Phillips again, out at the Wilmot Farm, Grover's Mill, New Jersey. Hundreds of cars are parked in a field in back of us, and the police are trying to rope off the roadway leading into the farm, but it's no use. They're breaking right through. Cars' headlights throw an enormous spotlight on the pit where the object's half buried. Now, ladies and gentlemen, there's something I haven't mentioned in all this excitement, but it's becoming more distinct. Perhaps you've caught it already on your radio. Listen, please. Do you hear it? It's a curious humming sound that seems to come from inside the object. I'll move the microphone nearer. Here. Now, we're not more than 25 feet away. Can you hear it now? Professor Pearson...
Yes, of course.
Can you tell us the meaning of that scraping noise inside the thing?
Possibly the unequal cooling of its surface.
I say, do you still think it's a meteor, Professor?
I don't know what to think. The metal casing is definitely extraterrestrial. Not found on this Earth. Friction with the Earth's atmosphere usually tears holes in a meteorite. This thing is smooth and... You can see it's cylindrical
shape. Just a minute. Something's happening. Ladies and gentlemen, this terrific.
The crowd gathered on the common,
this end of the
hypnotized by the unscrewing of the cylinder. 2 feet of shining screw projected when suddenly the lid fell off.
Wait a minute. Someone's caught something I can see tearing out of that black hole through luminous disk.
2 luminous, disc-like eyes appeared above the rim. A huge, rounded bulk, larger than a bear, rose up slowly, glistening like wet leather. Its lipless mouth quivered and slavered, and snake-like tentacles writhed as the clumsy body heaved and pulsated.
Something wriggling out of the shadow like a gray snake. Now it's another one, and another one, and another one. They look like tentacles to me. Oh, yeah, I can see the thing's body now. It's large. It's large as a bear. It glistens like wet leather, but that face, ladies and gentlemen, it's indescribable. I can hardly force myself to keep looking at it. It's so awful. The eyes are black and they gleam like a serpent. The mouth is a kind of V-shape with saliva dripping from its rimless lips. It seems to quiver and pulsate, and the monster or whatever it is can hardly move. It seems weighed down by possibly gravity or something. The thing's rising up now, and the crowd falls back. It seems plenty. The most extraordinary experience, ladies and gentlemen. I can't find words. Well, I'll pull this microphone with me if they talk. More state police have arrived. They're drawing up a cordon in front of the pit. About 30 of them. No need to push the crowd back now. They're willing to keep their distance. The captain conferring with someone. Can't quite see who. Oh, yes, I believe it's Professor Pearson. Yes, it is. Now they've parted, and the professor moves around one side, studying the object while the captain and 2 policemen advance with something in their hands. I can see it now. It's a white handkerchief tied to a pole. Flag of truce. Those creatures know what that means, what anything means. Wait a minute, something's happening. A humped shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against the mirror.
Two men crept closer to the pit. A tall funnel rose, and an invisible ray of heat leapt from man to man, and there was a bright glare as each was instantly turned to fire. Every tree and bush became a mass of flames at the touch of this savage, unearthly heat.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've just been handed a message that came in from Grover's Mill by telephone. At least 40 people, including 6 state troopers, lie dead in a field east of the village of Grover's Mill, their bodies burned and distorted beyond all possible recognition. The next voice you hear will be that of Brigadier General Montgomery Smith, commander of the state militia at Trenton, New Jersey.
I have been requested by the governor of New Jersey to place the counties of Mercer and Middlesex as far west as Princeton and east to Jamesburg under martial law. No one will be permitted to enter this area except by special pass issued by state or military authority. Thank you.
You have just been listening to General Montgomery Smith, commanding the state militia at Trenton. In the meantime, further details of the catastrophe at Grover's Mill are coming in. The strange creatures, after unleashing their deadly assault, crawled back in their pit and made no attempt to prevent the efforts of the firemen to recover the bodies and extinguish the fire. We have been unable to establish any contact with our mobile unit at Grover's Mill.
People clawed their way off the common, and I ran too. I felt I was being toyed with, that when I was on the very verge of safety, this mysterious death would leap after me and strike me down. At last I reached Maybury Hill, and in the dim coolness of my home, I wrote an account for my newspaper before I sank into a restless, haunted sleep.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have just been informed that we have finally established communication with an eyewitness of the tragedy. Professor Pearson has been located at a farmhouse near Grover's Mill, where he has established an emergency observation post. Professor Pearson.
Of the creatures in the rocket cylinder at Grover's Mill, I can give you no authoritative information either as to their nature, their origin, or their purposes here on Earth. Of their destructive instrument, I might venture some conjectural explanation. It's my guess that in some way they are able to generate an intense heat in a chamber of practically absolute non-conductivity. This intense heat they project in a parallel beam against any object they choose by means of a polished parabolic mirror of unknown composition. Much as the mirror of a lighthouse projects a beam of light. That is my conjecture of the origin of the heat ray.
I awoke to alien sounds of hammering from the pit and hurried to the railway station to buy the paper.
Ladies and gentlemen, here is a bulletin from Trenton. It is a brief statement informing us that the charred body of Carl Phillips has been identified in the Trenton Hospital.
Around me, the daily routine of life, working, eating, sleeping, was continuing serenely as it had for countless years.
Believing that radio has a responsibility to serve in the public interest at all times, we are turning over our facilities to the state militia at Trenton.
On Horsell Common, the Martians continued hammering and stirring, sleepless, indefatigable, at work upon the machines they were making. Now and again a light, like the beam of a warship's searchlight, swept the common, and the heat ray was ready to follow.
We take you now to the field headquarters of the state militia near Grover's Mill, New Jersey.
This is Captain Lansing of the Signal Corps attached to the state militia. A cylindrical object lies in a pit directly below our position, surrounded on all sides by 8 battalions of infantry. I can see their hiding place plainly in the glare of the searchlights here. With all their reported resources, these creatures can scarcely stand up against heavy machine gun fire. Anyway, it's an interesting outing for the troops. I can make out their khaki uniforms crossing back and forth in front of the lights. Looks almost like a real war. There appears to be some slight smoke in the woods bordering the Millstone River. Probably fire started by campers. Well, we ought to see some action soon. One of the companies is deploying on the left flank. A quick thrust and it'll all be over. Now, wait a minute. I see something on top of the cylinder. No, it's nothing but a shadow. Now the troops are on the edge of the Wilmoth Farm. 7,000 armed men closing in on an old metal tube. Well, wait, that wasn't a shadow. It's something moving. Solid metal, kind of a shield-like affair rising up out of the cylinder. Going higher and higher. What? It's standing on legs, actually rearing up on a sort of metal framework. Hold on.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have a grave announcement to make. Incredible as it may seem, both the observations of science and the evidence of our eyes lead to the inescapable assumption that those strange beings who landed in the Jersey farmlands tonight are the vanguard of an invading army from the planet Mars. The battle which took place tonight at Grover Mills has ended in one of the most startling defeats ever suffered by an army in modern times. 7,000 men armed with rifles and machine guns pitted against a single fighting machine of the invaders from Mars. 120 known survivors. The rest strewn over the battle area from Grover's Mill to Plainsboro, crushed and trampled to death under the metal feet of the monster, or burned to cinders by its heat ray.
The hammering from the pit and the pounding of guns grew louder. My fear rose at the sound of someone creeping into the house. Then I saw it was a young artilleryman, weary, streaked with blood and dirt.
Anyone here?
Come in. Here, drink this.
Thank you.
What's happened?
They wiped us out. Hundreds dead, maybe thousands.
The heat ray?
The Martians. They were inside the hoods of machines they'd made. Massive metal things on legs. Giant machines that walked. They attacked us. They wiped us out.
Machines?
Fighting machines. Picking up men and bashing them against trees. Just hunks of metal, but they knew exactly what they were doing.
There was another cylinder game last night.
Yes. Does it look bound for London?
London? Carrie. I hadn't dreamed there could be danger to Carrie and her father so many miles away. I must go to London at once.
And me. Got to report to headquarters. If there's anything left of it.
The Secretary of the Interior.
I wish to impress upon you, private citizens and public officials, all of you, the urgent need of calm and resourceful action. Fortunately, this formidable enemy is still confined to a comparatively small area, and we may place our faith in the military forces to keep them there.
Here's a bulletin from Winston Field, Long Island. A fleet of army bombers carrying heavy explosives flying north in pursuit of enemies. Scouting planes act as guides. They keep the speeding enemy in sight.
Here they are! What did I tell you?
Langham Field, Virginia. Scouting planes report 3 Martian machines visible above treetops, moving north toward Somerville with population fleeing ahead of them. They seem to be making a conscious effort to avoid destruction of cities and countryside. Wherever they stop to uproot power lines, bridges, and railroad tracks, their apparent objective is to crush resistance, paralyze communication, and disorganize human society.
Quickly, one after the other, four of the fighting machines appear. Monstrous tripods, higher than the tallest steeple, striding over the pine trees and smashing them. Walking engines of glittering metal, each carried a huge funnel, and I realized with horror that I'd seen this awful thing before.
First, we take you to the battery of the 22nd Field Artillery, located in the Watching Mountains.
37 degrees. Fire!
Hit that. That's the tripod of one of them. Stop. The others are trying to repair it.
Quick, get the range. Shift 50, 30 meters.
Six guns we had seen now fired simultaneously, decapitating a fighting machine. The Martian inside the hood was slain, splashed to the four winds, and the body, nothing now but an intricate device of metal, went whirling to destruction. As the other monsters advanced, people ran away blindly, the artilleryman among them. But I jumped into the water and hid until forced up to breathe. Now the guns spoke again.
Fire.
But this time, the heat ray sent them to oblivion.
Newark, New Jersey. Warning. Poisonous black smoke pouring in from Jersey marshes. Streets of South Street. Gas masks useless. Urge populations move into open spaces. Automobiles use Route 7, 23... 24.
Army bombing plane V-843 off Bayonne, New Jersey. Lieutenant Boat commanding 8 bombers, reporting to Commander Fairfax Langham Field. This is Boat reporting to Commander Fairfax Langham Field. Enemy tripod machines now in sight. Reinforced by 3 machines from the Morristown cylinder. 6 altogether. 1 machine partially crippled. Believed hit by shell from Army gun in Watchung Mountains. Guns now appear silent. A heavy black fog hanging close to the earth of extreme density, nature unknown. No sign of heat ray. Enemy now turns east, crossing Passaic River into the Jersey marshes. Another straddles the Pulaski Skyway. Evident objective is New York City. They're pushing down a high-tension power station. Machines are close together now, and we're ready to attack. Flames circling, ready to strike. A 1,000 yards, and we'll be over the first. There they go. Giant arm raised. Green flash. Spraying us with flame. 2,000 feet. Engines are giving out. No chance to release bombs. Only one thing left, drop on them, plane and all. We're diving on the first one. Now the engine's gone. 8.
The Martians released their black smoke, but the ship sped on, cutting down one of the tripod figures. Instantly, the others raised their heat rays and melted the Thunder Child's valiant heart.
Speaking from the roof of Broadcasting Building, New York City, the bells you hear are ringing to warn the people to evacuate the city as Martians approach. Estimated in the last 2 hours, 3 million people have moved out along the roads to the north. Hutchinson River Parkway is still kept open for motor traffic. Void bridges to Long Island hopelessly jammed. All communication with Jersey Shore closed 10 minutes ago. No more defenses. Our army is wiped out. Artillery, Air Force, everything wiped out. This may be the last broadcast. We'll stay here to the end. Wait a minute. The enemy is now in sight above the Palisades. 5 great machines. First one is crossing the river. I can see it from here, waiting,
wading the Hudson like a man wading through a brook.
We saw tripods wading up the Thames, cutting through bridges as though they were paper. Waterloo Bridge, Westminster Bridge. One appeared above Big Ben.
Now they're lifting their metal hands. This is the end now. Smoke comes out, black smoke drifting over the city. People in the streets see it now. They're running toward the East River, thousands of them, dropping in like rats.
Never before in the history of the world had such a mass of human beings moved and suffered together. This was no disciplined march. It was a stampede, without order and without a goal. 6 million people, unarmed and unprovisioned, driving headlong. It was the beginning of the rout of civilization, of the massacre of mankind.
Now the smoke's spreading faster. It's reached Times Square. People are trying to run away from it, but it's no use. They're falling like flies. Now the smoke's crossing 6th Avenue. 5th Avenue. 100 yards away. It's 50 feet.
The leaden sky was lit by green flashes, cylinder following cylinder, and no one and nothing was left now to fight them. The Earth belonged to the Martians.
2X2L calling CQ New York. Is there anyone on the air? Isn't there anyone?
You are listening to a CBS presentation of Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the Air in an original dramatization of The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
I set down these notes on paper. I'm obsessed by the thought that I may be the last living man on Earth. I've been hiding in this empty house near Grover's Mill, a small island of daylight cut off by the black smoke from the rest of the world. All that happened before the arrival of these monstrous creatures in the world now seems part of another life. Keep watch at the window. At length, there's a hissing sound, and suddenly I see a Martian mounted on his machine, spraying the air with a jet of steam as if to dissipate the smoke. I watch in a corner as his huge metal legs nearly brush against the house. Exhausted by terror, I fall asleep. Morning. Morning. Sun streams in the window.
Next day, the dawn was a brilliant, fiery red, and I wandered through the weird and lurid landscape of another planet. For the vegetation which gives Mars its red appearance had taken root on Earth. As man had succumbed to the Martians, so our land now succumbed to the red weed.
I venture from the house. I make my way to a road, no traffic. Here and there, a wrecked car, baggage overturned, a blackened skeleton. Push on north. For some reason, I feel safer trailing these monsters than running away from them. And I keep a careful watch. I've seen the Martians feed. Should one of their machines appear over the top of trees, I'm ready to fling myself flat on the earth. Push on north. I find dead cows in a brackish field, and beyond the charred ruins of a dairy and a silo, remain standing guard over the wasteland like a lighthouse. Deserted by the sea. Astride the silo perches a weathercock. The arrow points north. North. Next day I come to a city. City vaguely familiar in its contours, yet its buildings strangely dwarfed and leveled off as if a giant had sliced off its highest towers with a capricious sweep of his hand. Reached the outskirts, I found Newark. Newark, undemolished but humbled by some whim of the advancing Martians.
Again, I was on my way to London, through towns and villages that were blackened ruins, totally silent, desolate, deserted. Man's empire had passed away, taken swiftly and without error by these creatures who were composed entirely of brain. Unhampered by the complex systems which make up man, they made and used different bodies according to their needs. They never tired, never slept, and never suffered, having long since eliminated from their planet the bacteria which cause all fevers and other morbidities.
Presently, with an odd feeling of being watched, I caught sight of something crouching in a doorway. I made a step towards it.
There's no food here. This is my country. All this end of town down the river. There's only food for one. Which way are you going?
I don't know. I guess I'm looking for people.
Hey, we're in the open here. Let's crawl in this doorway here and talk.
Have you seen any Martians?
5 days ago, a couple of them carried something big across the flats from the airport. I think they're learning how to fly.
Fly?
Yeah, fly.
Then it's all over with humanity.
We're not going to be exterminated. I don't mean to be caught either. Tamed and fattened and bred like an ox.
What are you going to do?
I'm going on. Right under their feet. I got a plan. To live underground. I've been thinking about the sewers. Under New York, there are miles and miles of them. The main ones, they're big enough for anybody. Then there's cellars, vaults, underground storerooms, railway tunnels, subways. Get all the books we can. Science books. That's where men like you come in, see? We raid the museums. We'll even spy on the Martians. Just imagine this. 4 or 5 of their own fighting machines suddenly start off. Heat rays right and left. Not a Martian in them. Not a Martian in them, see? But men. Men who've learned the way how. Maybe in our time. Gee. Imagine having one of them lovely things with a heat ray wide and free. We'd turn it on Martians. We'd turn it on men. We'd bring everybody down on their knees.
That's your plan.
Yeah. You. Me. We'd own the world.
I see.
Hey. Hey, what's the matter? Where are you going?
Not to your world. Bye, stranger. Well, after parting with the artilleryman, I came at last to the Holland Tunnel, entered that silent tube. Anxious to know the fate of the great city on the other side of the Hudson. Cautiously, I came out of the tunnel and made my way up Canal Street. Reached 14th Street, and there again were black powder and several bodies and an evil, ominous smell from the gratings of the cellars of some of the houses. I wandered up through the 30s and 40s. Stood alone on Times Square. Walked up Broadway in the direction of that strange powder, that silent shop windows, displaying their mute wares to empty sidewalks.
There were a dozen dead bodies in the Euston Road, their outlines softened by the black dust. All was still. Houses locked and empty. Shops closed. But looters had helped themselves to wine and food. And outside a jeweler's, some gold chains and a watch were scattered on the pavement.
Near Columbus Circle, I noticed models of 1939 motor cars in the showrooms facing empty streets. Over the top of the General Motors building, I watched a flock of black birds circling in the sky.
I saw over the trees on Primrose Hill the fighting machine from which the howling came. I crossed Regent's Canal. There stood a second machine, upright, but as still as the first. I looked up and saw a third machine. It was erect and motionless, like the others. An insane resolve possessed me. would give my life to the Martians here and now.
I rushed recklessly across Columbus Circle and into the park. I climbed a small hill above the pond at 60th Street. From there, I could see standing in a silent row along the mall 19 of those great metal titans, their cowls empty, their steel arms hanging listlessly by their sides. I looked in vain for the monsters that inhabit those machines. Suddenly, my eyes were attracted to the immense flock of black birds that hovered directly below me. They circled to the ground. And there before my eyes, stark and silent, lay the Martians with the hungry birds pecking and tearing brown shreds of flesh from their dead bodies. Later, when their bodies were examined in laboratories, it was found that they were killed by the putrefactive and diseased bacteria against which their systems were unprepared.
Directly the invaders arrived and drank and fed, our microscopic allies attacked them. From that moment, they were doomed.
Plain, after all, man's defenses had failed. They're the humblest thing that God, as wisdom, has put upon this earth. Before the cylinder fell, there was general persuasion that through all the deep of space, no life existed beyond the petty surface of our minute sphere. Now we see further. Maybe that the destruction of the Martians is only a reprieve to them and not to us. The future ordained, perhaps.
Tonight marks the 50th anniversary of the original broadcast of the Orson Welles Mercury Theater radio play. We're in the 90th year of the book's popularity, 35th year of the films, and 10th year for the album, and the great War of the Worlds machine marches still. This weekend in particular has seen a vast resurgence in interest in the 1938 phenomenon. The actual town of Grover's Mill, New Jersey, is staging a four-day festival in honor of the 50th anniversary of its invasion, unveiling a plaque of commemoration and burying a time capsule to be dug up in another 50 years. Just tonight on American Public Radio, they aired a faithful recreation of the original broadcast starring Jason Robards in the Orson Welles role. Just last night, those of you able to receive Channel 50 from Watertown or Channel 9 from Syracuse may have seen the latest episode of the new Toronto-based syndicated television series War of the Worlds. In this program, Grover's Mill was invaded by alien bikers, some of which were played by Canadian rock group Platinum Blonde. Unfortunately, now as then, people in Ottawa couldn't pick it up. This specific interest coincides with a more general cultural fascination with the concept of alien beings. Today, the public debate has never been hotter about whether or not this planet will be, has been, or is being visited by extraterrestrial life forms, and if so, what their intentions might be. It may be just a colossal coincidence the two key purveyors of this fictional war were named Welles, but then it could be a clue, a message hidden in our cultural tapestry that in the works of these men lie wells of knowledge, should we only choose to drink. E.T. and Alf may not be the good friends we thought they were, or hope like hell they'll be.
The landing craft touched down on Mars 28 kilometers from the aim point. We're looking at a remarkable landscape, littered with different kinds of rocks, red, purple. How about that, Bermuda?
Fantastic. Look at that dune field.
Hey, wait, I'm getting a no-go signal. Now I'm losing one of the craft. Hey, Bermuda, you getting it?
I lost contact. There's a lot of dust blowing up there.
Now I lost the second craft. We got problems.
All contact lost, Pasadena. Maybe the antennas.
What's that flare? See it? A green flare coming from Mars. Kind of a green mist behind it. It's getting closer. You see it, Bermuda? Come in, Bermuda. Houston, come in. What's going on? Tracking station 43, Canberra. Come in, Canberra. Tracking station 63. Can you hear me, Madrid? Can anybody hear? Come in.
This has been an exploration of the War of the Worlds, realized in the studios of Shea 106 with the valuable research assistance of Roger Martineau, Barry Burns, Bill Alexander, and the Ottawa Public Library. Look for a live theatrical version of the Jeff Wayne album to appear in Ottawa sometime in 1989. This special presentation was written, produced, and narrated by Jeff Green. Tune in tomorrow night at 9 for Vigilante, the first of three monthly half-hour horror stories by Jeff Green, and have a happy Halloween.
Stranger Media. To find out more about the works of Jeff Green, go to strangermedia.com.